Welcome to another episode of the Best Anchor Stocks podcast. This week, I was lucky enough to be joined for the second time by Ryan O'Connor, founder and CEO of Crossroads Capital. Crossroads Capital holds a significant position in Nintendo, and as Nintendo recently hosted the Switch 2 Direct, we decided to focus the episode on what's next for the Japanese video game and IP giant. Before jumping right into the episode, don't forget that you can find my work on quality companies at bestanchorstocks.com. And finally, a quick disclaimer. The information discussed in the episode is shared with informational purposes only and shouldn't be taken as investment advice. The participants hold, as of the date of this podcast, positions in the security discussed. Now, let's go right into the episode. So Ryan, welcome again to the podcast, second time guest. And the last episode we discussed Nintendo, and in this episode we're going to discuss Nintendo. But I think now with many more news to talk about Nintendo, before we discussed the thesis, and now we're going to discuss maybe how the thesis is playing out. So thank you for coming.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Leandro. Last time was fun. I think this one will be even more fun. So yeah. Should I start with kind of the direct and kind of go from there?
Yeah, let's start, because just to give people context, so Nintendo hosted a Nintendo Direct April 2nd, where they unveiled the more details about the Switch 2, which we already knew was coming. So what were your general impressions of the Direct?
It's kind of a long question or answer, but I thought it was near perfect. There were a couple takes, if you will, that I wished, or I had kind of more positive view as far as how things would kind of balance out on. But, you know, net, it was probably considerably better than my kind of best case before. So kind of breaking it into, you know, the basic points that I loved. So there was the device issue, you know, the Switch itself. I thought it was absolutely fantastic. I thought if there was one place where they could, get it wrong, maybe it would be, you know, here. But, net, I thought it was awesome. It was everything I hoped it would be. In fact, I think the performance uplift is a little better than kind of my best case hope. One element that I'll get to that. So the device was great. In terms of surprises, I thought the mic, the camera, the new chat feature was absolutely fantastic. It's kind of adds, at least the chat in particular, kind of a network effect, like say, you know, PlayStation or Bloomberg or Discord, but kind of inside the walled garden. You know, when you think about a lot of the stickiness of, you know, the kind of, you know, historically higher powered consoles like Sony and PlayStation and Xbox, the thing that comes to mind in terms of the stickiness of the platform is, you know, the ability to chat with your friends playing games. You know, I don't know how many people I know that the only time they play video games is, you know, they'll jump on and play like Call of Duty with the same group of guys that they played with in high school. And that kind of community aspect has been historically missing with Nintendo. And so to, you know, not only provide that functionality, but actually innovate on what has historically been the case with the other consoles by allowing, you know, these group members to basically play any game they want, as opposed to being kind of forced into all playing Call of Duty or pick your kind of Fortnite, any game like that. So I thought that was, it seems like a small nuanced point, but I think the ability to play.
Do you have any thoughts on the attach rate that the camera might have? So how many cameras do you think Nintendo is going to sell per Switch to sold?
So, you know, I don't know is the real answer, but I suspect it will be good. And I expect it'll be very, very, very high for, you know, people that's primary console is either, you know, an Xbox or PlayStation. So kind of the hardcore or higher end gaming enthusiasts, you know, whether they already, you know, they own a Switch or, you know, it's someone that has never owned a Switch before and has been converted because of what I'll get into next, which is, you know, the mouse functionality, which I think is a huge, huge, huge game changer with respect to converting the high-end gamer. But I think in general, the high-end gamer is going to have, this will kind of be essential to their gameplay for kind of obvious reasons. But I think that was a wonderful surprise to see.
I think people didn't didn't think the Switch could be more versatile, and they came out with a mouse, which is actually incredible.
Probably the smartest thing they've ever done. I think this, you know, the chat functionality is right up there too. But, you know, I mean, what are there? I think 1.86 billion PC gamers in the world. And, you know, here's an interesting data point of the, you know, total Xbox and PlayStation ecosystems. I believe there's something like 110 million, you know, gamers still playing on prior gen consoles. And, you know, on top of that, you know, another interesting data point to kind of frame this is that something like 53% of all hours played on those prior gen consoles, you know, and it's not just the prior gen, but the current gen, are old games. And what I mean by old games, you know, they call it the Big Five or something like that. But it's Call of Duty, Minecraft. What is it? I think it's FC. What are they? I'd have to pull out my notes. But, you know, they're all games where, with the exception, I think of one where mouse functionality is essential to the experience. And so when you have basically, let's call it, it's not 100, it's 107 million. It is 107 million in total, now that I think about it, that are on prior consoles. And my theory, you know, we'll see in the numbers as it plays out, but, you know, most of those gamers, you know, continue to play or haven't upgraded to the, you know, most recent, you know, console within Xbox and PlayStation, because, you know, they play these games that will now be available on the Switch 2 in true fidelity to their intended gameplay. But, you know, a lot of them play with a mouse, you know, because that is, you know, I don't want to call it an edge, but it is kind of critical to the way they play. And more than that, they play with, you know, groups of friends. And none of that would have been possible on the Switch 1. So in terms of kind of peeling off, you know, this massive TAM of you know, high-end, higher-spending gamers and giving them a reason to finally upgrade. You know, I think the implications in terms of, you know, where Nintendo's active playing user count will balance out, you know, call it 3 to 4 years from today are kind of profound. You know, so
now that we are talking about prior gen consoles, I think one interesting thing is that in the prior cycle, right, when the Switch 1 was released, Nintendo was basically starting from scratch. And now when the Switch 2 is going to be released, Nintendo actually has a pretty healthy business with the Switch 1 platform, right? I think they guide to sell around 11 million hardware units this year and 150 million software units. That did not include the release of the Switch 2, which is happening in fiscal 26, but evidently those numbers might be optimistic. We'll see. Yep. How do you think that the Switch 1 platform transitions now when the Switch 2 arrives? Do you think it's going to still bring pretty healthy business for Nintendo, or do you expect a mass exodus to the Switch 2 platform?
Well, you know, I don't think, you know, if in the latter that you just mentioned, that implies kind of mind-blowing Switch 2 console and software sales. So, you know, that wouldn't necessarily be the worst thing. But I think, you know, Nintendo will do what it's always done, which is to support the previous console for another couple of years. Practically speaking, what I think that means is most, or I'd say, you know, at least half of, historically it's been most, where they've had a new, like with their portables upgrade, the new games are predominantly cross-gen, as we would say. So available, you know, put on both the old system and the new to kind of maximize the profits from the, you know, large active base of active players. So, you know, this time, you know, before I get to that, I think, you know, historically they've put two or three exclusives out at the beginning. And the idea there has been to, you know, provide a reason for people to upgrade while also maintaining, you know, kind of the large install base and, you know, everything that flows from that. So I think that the transition will be seamless. I think they win essentially in every way. I mean, if you're a high-end gamer that doesn't have a Switch, the games on offer, you know, especially given they will be automatically, quote unquote, upgraded via better visuals and, you know, and running at higher frame rates. I mean, what sells consoles, the game library, and for a new gamer to come into the Switch ecosystem and not just have everything that was announced at the Direct, but, you know, the entire library of original Switch 1 games, you know, many of which are masterpieces, and to get those games, you know, with better, you know, graphics and running at much higher frame rates, you know, as if they were kind of remastered all on day one, is, you know, kind of an immensely powerful, you know, carrot as far as, you know, purchasing what remains, I think, the cheapest ticket to an ecosystem with the best, you know, IP library and games that exist. So I think there's lots of ways we can talk about this, but that's the part that I'm most excited about. And I think, you know, in many ways, people don't really fully understand the implications of the console changeover that's about to take place.
And I think also an interesting point is that once you bring the hardcore gamer into the franchise, then you're going to get a lot more content shared on YouTube, for example, or or on Twitch. So then you're going to sort of drive this network effect where people are going to be looking at the Switch. I think the Pokemon card game has had a similar impact in how widespread it's been on social media. So before the Switch 1 and the PS5, the gap was pretty large, right, in specs. Where do you think that gap lies today between the PS5 and the Switch 2?
That's a great question. So according to the actual game devs themselves, they are kind of overjoyed with not only the ease of porting games. I was just at the GDC conference at San Francisco, the big game development conference, which was absolutely huge. It kind of blew my mind how big it was, equivalent to Tokyo Games Fest in Japan, which, you know, I was there on the business to business day, and, you know, it was like being like herding cattle through the place. So, you know, I think that the ease of porting is there. I think if you look at, I mean, for example, I think Cyberpunk, you know, the images in the Direct that they showed there, this was a game that wasn't available on the PS4, if I remember correctly, and almost bricked the PS5, you know, because, you know, they kind of released it early or whatnot. But as far as, you know, kind of modern games, you know, this is a great example of, you know, how, you know, obviously the Switch 2 is not going to be, in terms of raw power, in line with, you know, the PS5. But, you know, when you take its base power level, which I, you know, has been confirmed as essentially a PS4 Pro, and then you add NVIDIA's AI DLSS, which, you know, upscales these games considerably, you know, I think the gap between, you know, the games that you see on the Switch 2 and, you know, kind of the current gen systems goes away for the most part. And I still think people are internalizing this, but with the Cyberpunk images you saw, I think they started to port that game 7 weeks prior to the footage that we witnessed in the Direct. And that is pretty incredible. I mean, for those that don't know, the very last piece of the game development process is the optimization of games. So like for with the Switch 1, I believe when we had the first Direct where they showcased Mario Odyssey and, you know, a few other games, Mario Odyssey was running at something like P. And then, you know, by the time it was actually released, it was running flawlessly, at, I think, 980. But the point is that this wasn't a finished version of the game. And what actually ended up released ended up being quite a bit better. So to have a game like Cyberpunk that looks as good as it did, you know, in the Direct, where it was literally started from zero 7 weeks beforehand, and, you know, it basically already looks, you know, visually at parity, I think that really kind of says it all. It's pretty incredible. So, you know, the feedback from the people I've talked to is that it is great. Is it, you know, internally, you know, kind of raw specs as powerful as the PS5? No. But, you know, given all the extra bells and whistles, DLS with, you know, from NVIDIA, I think it's going to be, you know, essentially neck and neck, and certainly allow them to adopt, you know, or port the, you know, best games on current consoles to the Switch 2 at a level of fidelity that, you know, all but, you know, the crazies will, I mean, there won't be a visual or performance difference that, you know, is kind of material to, you know, the average gamer today. I think that's pretty clear.
To give credit to Nintendo, I think a lot of people
were skeptical that Nintendo was following the right strategy, right? By not chasing the best graphics like Sony or Microsoft were. And I think Nintendo has demonstrated that they were indeed following the right strategy by making and focusing on the games and how enjoyable they are, and not so much on how good they look. Evidently, the Switch One was maybe behind what people expected, especially after 8 years, not maybe when it came out. So I think a lot of people tend to think that the Switch 2 needs to be like the PS5, but I think the difference is that if the Switch 2 is good enough for AAA games, then that's good enough for gamers and for Nintendo. I don't know, what do you think about that?
I think that's 100% correct. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, the only thing anyone really cares about is, are games fun? You know, how good is the gameplay? I mean, and if, you know, the fact that Nintendo absolutely destroyed Xbox and PlayStation last generation with, you know, games that were running essentially on 10-year-old hardware, if that doesn't kind of drive home that point, I'm not sure what else, you know, you could say. But that actually, I think, goes into another point of why you're going to see this absolute flood of AAA games come onto the Switch 2 platform for the first time in 25 years, is the fact that, you know, the economics of AAA software for the other consoles is absolutely broken for any number of levels. I mean, I think Microsoft's decision to take their exclusives multi-plat, you know, illustrates this point exactly. And even PlayStation has started to port over a lot of its former exclusive games. You know, there was like 4 games on the Switch 2 Direct that had formerly been Sony exclusives. But, you know, they're doing it, and I think this is a powerful insight, not because I do think they want to, but they really don't have any choice. And, you know, this is a function of some of these massive AAA games today cost upwards of, you know, $400 million. And it's because it's not just, you know, the excess cost from kind of fetishizing photorealistic games, you know, and how much incremental cost that puts into the development budget. But, you know, it's also, they're basically mostly motion cap movies on top of that, motion capture. So think Planet of the Apes, where you have actual actors come in, scripts written. So with these games having such kind of mind-boggling budgets, you know, there's not enough active gamers in their existing installed bases to make the economics work. So, you know, if a lot of these games and studios want to survive, they have to go where the gamers are. And the biggest pool of you know, existing gamers is the Switch ecosystem. So, you know, our feedback with talking to people is, you know, they love the system. They love the ease of its portability relative to in the past. They aren't having to make any sacrifices in terms of the way these games are intended to be played. You know, so the very few AAA games that were put on the Switch were basically dumbed down versions. You know, that those kind of limitations have completely gone away. So, you know, there's that element of it. You know, they like to make money, I'm sure, but it's not really a choice in the end, because, you know, the cost of these games has gotten so kind of out of whack that, you know, if they fail, it's a disaster. And even if they win, you know, there's not enough users to, you know, I think predictably, or in some cases realistically, earn their cost they've put into the game back. And so that is another kind of driver that is going to be a game changer, I think, when the Switch 2 comes out.
Now, and talking about cost, one thing that a lot of people didn't like about the Switch, it's kind of become a controversial topic, is the pricing, right? So the Switch 2, the hardware, I think it's going to cost 54% more than the Switch 1. It's at $459, whereas the Switch 1 was $300 at launch. And the software, I think it's going to cost around $30 more, depending on if you're looking at the physical or digital versions. What do you think this price increase might mean for Nintendo in terms of demand and its user base? And also, I think a very interesting topic is, what is this price increase going to mean for the industry, right? Because there have been already some comments around GTA, the next GTA game costing maybe $100, but the industry has not given this step forward to increase software prices, and Nintendo has come out with higher prices. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think the hysteria is objectively absurd on a number of levels. So I think also this is, I think, kind of par for the course, not just for this reaction in terms of pricing. I mean, obviously, no one likes to pay higher prices. But when you go back and you look at every console release in recent memory, one of the first things that happens is people, you know, start to whine about, you know, it being more expensive. And, you know, I mean, for example, I think with the, you know, when the original Switch came out, I shouldn't say, I know. I think it was, people thought it was going to be priced at like 260 or 280. The stock sold off, I think, 6% in Japan the next day. And, you know, as we know, things, you know, worked out just fine. And I believe Nintendo's stock price has quadrupled since that. So the immediate reaction, you know, isn't surprising. But in terms of the complaints, you know, maybe I'll start with Mario Kart, you know, because, you know, that was the $80 price point. So, you know, never mind that in real terms, you know, the game is priced, you know, inflation adjusted exactly as, you know, it was, you know, historically. And I believe the last four consoles Nintendo has had, you know, the pricing has basically tracked right in line with, you know, inflation. So, you know, it's not really, I mean, it's a price increase in terms of, you know, the nominal dollar amount, but, you know, in real terms, it's about the same. Also, you know, when I hear this stuff, it's like, you know, I can remember begging my dad in that, like, I think it was probably 1989, to buy me, you know, the Double Dragon video game on NES, and it was $60. You know, that was $160. That's $160, you know, in today's money. So, you know, video games have been, you know, historically much more expensive in real terms. And, you know, the last, you know, since, you know, call it 2000 and after, in real terms, you know, Nintendo's pricing has stabilized. But, you know, I find it funny. People have no idea how, you know, good they have it relative to, you know, game pricing in the past. But, you know, I think big picture, and this is the thing, I think, you know, you saw Doug Bowser kind of reiterate this in an interview on CNBC the other day when he was defending it, is that, you know, so Mario Kart, it's at $80. Well, in 2017 dollars, that's, I think, 78 right today. So again, as I said before, real pricing is the same. But you have to consider the durability of the game and, you know, how much, you know, call it a joy and fun you're going to have it from an hourly basis over the life that you own it. So, you know, we have, you know, an internal metric that I like to call, you know, the price to fun ratio, but it measures, you know, the cost of, you know, in hourly, you know, dollar terms to play, you know, a video game versus, say, other forms of entertainment media. So whether you're comparing it to going to a movie, you know, a Netflix subscription, you know, no matter how you kind of swing it, you know, the price to fun ratio is far and away the best in all of entertainment. You know, with Mario Kart World, let's say the average gamer that's a Mario Kart fan plays it for 200 hours. I actually think it's probably something double that, given the nature of the game. That's 40 cents per hour. So, you know, again, I think it's the single best value pound for pound in all of entertainment.
That would be, and that would be per person, right? And yeah. Mario Kart is a game that you play maybe when your friends come home and you play with them. So if you divide it by all the people that are playing, then the cost is close to zero.
Yes. I mean, it is an incredible deal. I mean, compare that to a movie, which is, you know, $20, it's $10 an hour. You know, like, you know, the idea that Nintendo's price gouging or being untoward or, you know, if anything, you know, I think the real argument would go the other way, which is given the, you know, magnitude of the, you know, the value differential to the consumer, they should be pricing it even higher, than, you know, where they're at. So, you know, I think it's consumer friendly. I think it is, you know, an incredible bargain. And, you know, just like with the Switch One, when everyone freaked out, you know, they started to play the games and then everyone forgot about it and realized, you know, The issue quickly went away, as it has, basically, every console switch over for the last 25 years. So it's par for the course. I mean, look at it this way, in terms of, and now maybe we can move to the Switch hardware, Switch 2 hardware and its pricing. You already laid out some math there, but and everything I said about games applies here too. But here we are, and we have pre-order demand in the UK and France and Japan. And mind you, in terms of the launch inventory that Nintendo has set aside for this console launch, because they have been kind of notified everyone that they're going to just basically churn out as many Switch 2s as they possibly can heading into launch to combat what has happened in the past, which is essentially they sell out and then getting a console for the next year or two is very, very difficult. And everything that kind of comes from that they're going to basically try and flood the market with as much Switch 2s as they can make. So retailers in general have more inventory at launch than they've ever had. And yet, amidst all that, excess inventory relative to the past and a day in which you had, a global stock market meltdown, plus all this complaining about pricing, I believe the UK, sold out in less than 2 minutes. It was like a half hour for France. Japan, there was so much demand in Japan that it literally broke the website for 5 days in a row. This thing is probably going to sell out day one, even despite their best efforts to flood the market with consoles. It's going to break console sale records. Nintendo's brand and, kind of the ubiquity of, the quality of their games has never been, better received. I mean, anyone that thinks, they're going to not absolutely murder, say, the average of consensus on Wall Street's, hardware estimates, frankly, isn't paying attention. I mean, not to mention above all, it's been 8 years since Nintendo's last console release. And one thing I don't think people really take into account is the embedded replacement demand from, quote unquote, upgraders, within the existing install base. And, by my math, based on conservative versions of churn, yada, 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 I think the Switch 2 should sell upwards of, 30 million in the first year. And so you have a situation.
What's Wall Street's consensus on Nintendo's launch?
I believe it's 17 or 18 million.
So basically like the first year and a half of the Switch 1 or so.
Yes, yes. I think it's the trailing 12 months post-release. And they were selling that in like the sixth year of the OG Switch era. So, it's preposterously low, for a source of, extraordinarily price inelastic consumer demand. And, you don't have to take my word for it. Look at the actual data that has been released in this last couple of days. I mean, to have 2 to 3 times the launch inventory at retailers in the UK on day one and to still sell out in minutes is quite the feat. And I think this actually speaks to the defensiveness of the name in a call it, in, given, let's just assume the tariff wars are long and drawn out.
It's interesting because if we have a recession, right, a lot of people would think, okay, this is a discretionary purchase. This gets murdered during a recession. And I recently wrote an article reviewing all of my companies and seeing how resilient they were to past recessions. And if you look at Nintendo in the GFC and the global financial crisis, they basically had the Nintendo DS and the Wii, and they murdered literally all estimates going into a recession. I mean, they were at all-time highs in revenue. It was incredible. So that made me think about how loyal the Nintendo customer is, right? Yeah. Not even a recession can get them away from buying a new hardware system.
You're right. And what's even more interesting, I mean, I think in terms of stress tests, that is about as hardcore of a stress test to compare historically at. But, also think about, there's a variety of other examples. For example, we were buying more when Nintendo sold off in terms of the yen carry trade unwind. And then you go back and you look at the Asian currency crisis, and this was in the lead up to the GameCube's launch. Nintendo was like one of the few equities that, you know, continued to rip right through the meltdown. In terms of, yes, it's a consumer product and therefore in theory should be more susceptible to deteriorating economic conditions. But when you look historically, if the hardware is on point and the games are there, is actually the opposite. Basically, nothing has been able to derail the kind of snowballing revenue and profits that are set for us to realize over the next 3 to 4 years.
Best Anchor Stocks is brought to you by the Chit Chat Stocks podcast. My name is Ryan.
And my name is Brett.
And we're the hosts of the show.
On Chit Chat Stocks, we are constantly researching new stocks from high flyers to undiscovered small caps, diving deep into business models, debating competitive advantages, dissecting valuations, and we have a fun time while doing it.
Supercharge your investing research and start listening to the podcast today. You can follow the Chit Chat Stocks podcast on YouTube, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts. Follow the show so you never miss an episode. That is the Chit Chat Stocks podcast.
And you talked there also about tariffs. So Nintendo, I think it was in Trump's first mandate in 2018 or 2019, started to diversify the manufacturing of the Switch from China to Vietnam. So now it's sort of a mix between both countries. And the other day we saw how not only did the U.S. threaten China with tariffs, but also Vietnam, and Vietnam's tariffs were pretty, I think they were around 46%. Mm-hmm. So how do you think that if that's actually going to be the status quo from now on, how do you think it will impact? I think the probability is low for Vietnam to remain with a 46% tariff. Yeah. I think they'll reach a deal. But let's imagine that they don't. How do you think it impacts the sale of the Switch 2?
I don't think it impacts it at all. And in fact, I actually think in various ways, specifically relating to the digitization of software sales, that actually might be, paradoxically enough, you know, the optimal world, at least in terms of Nintendo's bottom line. So, you know, high level.
In some ways, sorry to interrupt you. In some ways, sure. I think it's similar to when people were arguing that that cloud gaming was a risk for Nintendo. But at the same time, if you thought how a cloud gaming world would look for Nintendo, it would be like probably pure software sales at 90% margin, which wouldn't be a bad scenario. And I think this is sort of similar, right?
Yes. So, you know, obviously, you know, when the news came out, we kind of ran the math. And incredibly, you know, one thing that I think people, at least that analyze the video game industry, are generally familiar with is that as far as, you know, Xbox and PlayStation are concerned, you know, they have historically been more than willing to subsidize the hardware, i.e. sell it at a loss, given, you know, the real driver of the bottom line is obviously the software sales. You know, the bigger the installed base of connected devices, you know, the higher ceiling in terms of, you know, the mostly or increasingly high margin software sales are concerned. And as far as trade-offs are concerned, it's a no-brainer given the success of those consoles over time. Well, Nintendo's always been different, more like Apple, and insistence on hardware sales being profitable as well. And so typically that's somewhere between a 20 and 30% gross margin. And so the first thing I would, you know, want to start with is, so we ran the math, you know, given the breakdown between, you know, US hardware sales and the rest of the world, you know, the gross margin on, you know, global hardware sales or, you know, the consolidated gross margin, you know, gets cut in half, assuming, you know, the full 46% tariff and assuming Nintendo eats, you know, all of it, you know, for, you know, kind of our purposes. You know, we're trying to figure out the worst case. So, you know, the gross margin is still relatively healthy globally worldwide. Never mind the fact that, you know, given the embedded demand in the install base and, you know, what we're seeing in places of the world like Japan, France, and the UK, obviously Nintendo could redirect, you know, whatever hardware they sell in the first year to the rest of the world without, I think, impacting the total certainly at launch, what they were expecting. So, you know, there's an enormous amount of flexibility here. If you assume Nintendo increases pricing just to ensure that the US hardware sales break even, obviously the numbers look a little bit better, but this is hardly a tragedy, even in the worst case, even though I think, at least in terms of hardware, it's quite literally not a big deal.
And Nintendo is probably front-running. Well, I think Doug Bowser actually confirmed this, right? That Nintendo is already, there are already units in the US and Nintendo is shipping units to the US pre-tariffs.
Exactly. And I was going to, you know, I probably would have mentioned that up front, but, you know, I'm trying to think of, you know, if this stays in place for the next 5 years, how does that affect their bottom line? In terms of the likelihood of it affecting them if this gets resolved in, say, the next 3 to 6 months, then it's absolutely zero for this exact point, which is, you know, a couple months ago when they released the January kind of global shipping logs, we knew beyond a shadow of a doubt that, you know, at the run rate in which Switch 2s had started to arrive in the US, that they would have at least a few million consoles already here by launch day. So, and then, you know, Bowser confirmed that in the talk. So I honestly think the base case for whether these tariffs end up affecting Nintendo's hardware sales is, you know, zero for, you know, the reasons I've listed. But I think where it gets really interesting is thinking about how Nintendo would be forced to react on the software side, which is, again, is where all the money is at, and how that actually might not just, I mean, I think it will rapidly pull forward the ongoing mix shift in terms of the digitalization of their software sales and the exploding profits that come with that, given Nintendo is 4 to 5 years behind its higher powered console peers in that mix shift. So in general now, you know, you're looking at 85 to 90% of all video game sales on consoles not named Nintendo, you know, kind of balancing out between the, you know, 80 to 90% range, if you will. So, you know, Nintendo is in kind of fast catching up to that, but they have a considerably higher proportion of physical game sales, you know, which come at much lower profitability. Well, this is why, you know, and speaking of the direct, like, you know, one of the things initially that kind of stuck in my head was, you know, why would Nintendo spend, you know, 2 minutes or whatever it was talking about this, you know, game key card system, you know, relative to, say, you know, the NVIDIA's DLSS GPU in, you know, the console, given, you know, AI is, you know, one of the sexiest trends out there. Everyone knows about it. You know, you'd think it'd be a 100% natural thing to take priority, you know, in the presentation. And, you know, without going into all my thought process, there was some reason I could see for it. But as I sat and kind of discerned it, the light bulb went off and it kind of blew my mind. So I guess first of all, let's talk about what these game key cards are and why it's, you know, such an innovation. So you know, essentially in a nutshell, they are physical cards, so pieces of plastic that allow you to digitally download one of your games. And so that means there's no actual game data on the card, but you know, what is there is like a line of code that's like a, whatchamacallit, a license key. So it's code that unlocks the playability of the game. The only trade-off here is that the buyer of the game still has to digitally download it on their system beforehand. So let's kind of walk away or, you know, walk through four reasons why I think it's a game changer and truly kind of innovative in a way that directly affects Nintendo's bottom line. And I guess I should start by saying, since this is in context of the tariffs, digital downloads or, you know, digital game sales are not subject to, you know, tariffs.
Mm-hmm. So Nintendo in this scenario would have every incentive to try to pass the tariff on to consumers so that they consume the digital version of the game.
Yes, or they wouldn't keep the price the same, but they would essentially force all of their physical game sales into this new key card system. And so it is hugely attractive to 3P third-party developers as well. And that's already kind of, I think, being broadly adopted by, you know, third parties, you know, for release on the Switch system. Point number one. So, you know, these game cards cost, you know, considerably less compared to the higher capacity physical games where the whole game is on, you know, the piece of plastic. So one way you could kind of think about it as a cost saving measure that allows developers to reach both types of gamers without forcing a, you know, a consumer hated trade-off, at least amongst the physical crowd, while at the same time allowing that publisher to generate a digital, like, call it 85% gross margin on the software sales. So, you know, one way to think about this is that the key card concept strips all the capital intensity out of providing physical cartridges to the consumer. You know, and this is, again, because the only data on the plastic card isn't the whole game. It's just, you know, the license key. And the license key is essentially code that unlocks the playability of the game once it's digitally downloaded on the system beforehand. So, you know, digital purchases or digital game sales are typically 90% plus gross margins. You know, Nintendo with the, you know, physical key card, you know, innovation will have to pay, you know, a couple of bits to the retailer, you know, right in line with what retailers, you know, the gross margin on that retailers receive on console sales, you know, really for as long as I can remember, it has been this way. And then, you know, there's also, you know, some cost involved with the plastic and the card itself. So, you know, but that's, again, a couple of bips. So instead of 90% gross margins, you know, for a pure digital download, you know, the key card margins will be about 85%. But so, all for all intents and purposes, approximately the same. Yet they will be physical. And so that gets into point two, which is it basically simultaneously solves another big consumer problem here. And I think this is where the real innovation and that classic Nintendo genius comes in. Because whatchamacallit, let's see here, what are the purchases? So you can now, with these physical games, these key card games, you can transfer them just like you would a regular cart or a regular, you know, cartridge. So you can pull the cartridge out, give it to your friend. Your friend will have to digitally download the game, but he would be able to play it just as if he was borrowing your regular, you know, Nintendo game. This isn't possible with digital download sales because they're essentially tied to the device itself. So, and then on top of that, you know, this key card system allows for the sale of the game. So if you want to turn around, You buy the game, you don't like it, and you want to go sell it to GameStop or sell it to your buddy across the street, you know, now you can do that, which is, you know, from a consumer perspective, really the, you know, I think one of the primary or at least the largest points of why physical people that prefer physical games, you know, like them in the first place. So, you know, it basically takes away any of the pain or concern that has typically come with, you know, insisting on kind of direct ownership of the game itself. So you know, you don't need to be online. There's a bunch of reasons, but Nintendo essentially with this key card system allows the consumer to have their cake and eat it too. You know, they can buy the game. Yes, they all have to digitally download it, but they can turn around and they can sell it to their friends. They can seamlessly hand it off, let people borrow it. And so when you think about the impact that that will have to say Nintendo's Japanese software sales, where they have the largest chunk of gamers that, you know, still insist on playing, you know, or buying physical games, you can essentially convert, you know, 100% of those players, you know, immediately. And in context of the tariffs, where, you know, otherwise, you know, Nintendo would be forced to raise the price of the games, you know, the physical games relative to the digital games, which would act as a force function if they did it to drive the trends towards digital software sales or the mix shift even further along, would be, they could essentially do that day one. I think they're going to take a measured approach, but should the tariffs stay in place, you know, basically overnight, you know, say in our models, we have the digital mix shift going from, call it, you know, or let's just put it this way, approaching 80 to 85% of their total software sales in kind of like a linear fashion over the next 5 years. In a tariff war status quo, I think, you know, Nintendo would be essentially forced to implement, you know, key cards on their own physical first party sales. And I think third parties are already adopting them for the system as is, just because it's such a cost and you know, the margin benefit to them is there as well. And frankly, I think that, you know, the reason digital game sales has become essentially an unstoppable trend is because it's already vastly more convenient and, you know, soon to be, you know, much cheaper. Instead of having to get in your car, drive to Best Buy or someplace else, hope that they have games in stock, you know, which becomes a problem, especially if the game is possible. You can just sit in your on your couch at home, download the game, and it'll be available at midnight the day it comes out. So, you know, I already think...
And now Nintendo has removed another pain, right? Related to digital sales, which was the memory on the Switch, which is now much, much larger than for the Switch one.
Exactly. So that's another thing, is the bottleneck in terms of the cost goes up, the higher the memory is concerned. And so there's already kind of a bottleneck as games get more graphically intense and, you know, data intense, you know, the gap between what they can sell a digital game versus a physical game, you know, will only go up, i.e. the game, physical games will continually get more and more expensive. And without Nintendo, I mean, there's a certain point where it, kind of they're forced because demand becomes so low. I still assume physical games will be 10 to 15% for the collectors involved. But the fact that games are, you know, the storage, our needs for these games continually grow, having the Switch, you know, go from 30 to 256, and then you're going to be able to use these expanders, which, you know, you can go up to 1 trilobyte. If you go and you look at the memory or the storage needs for first party games, it's not that big of a deal. I mean, you'd be able to, on the 256, basically have something like 20 or 30 games available on your console at all times, you know, kind of immediately, but you can expand that substantially. You know, these increasing storage needs for, you know, a physical game sale, you know, there's a direct correlation between the bigger the game, the higher the cost of the physical cartridge to create. And so you put all these things together, and tariff wars or not, you actually hope for, you know, the tariffs to be an issue, because it'll pull forward, it'll allow Nintendo to pull a lever that, you know, should cause its profits to accelerate at an even faster rate than they would have, you know, without it. And I think that's extraordinarily sexy. I think in the end, no matter what the future holds, the kind of snowballing avalanche of revenue and profits that we should see for Nintendo's bottom line over the next 3 to 4 years is intact. And ironically, the best case outcome might actually be the worst case outcome for the global economy.
And before jumping into the valuation, I think it's also interesting to talk about Nintendo Switch Online, the Nintendo subscription, because one of the things that I think not surprised me, but I think it was a highlight in the Direct, was how collaborative they want to make the Switch 2, right? You've got the camera, you've got game chat. And in Nintendo, to be able to enjoy this collaboration, you need a Nintendo Switch Online subscription. Then they also talked about being able to enhance some Switch 1 games for the Switch 2, which would be theoretically free if you are a Nintendo Switch Online expansion pack subscriber.
Yep.
So do you think we are getting, because the Nintendo Switch Online currently has around 34, 35 million subscribers. That's the last disclosure that we had. And I think maybe some people expected the attach rate to be maybe higher considering all it brings. Do you think that we are going to see with the transition to the Switch to a new era for the NCO subscription and that the attach rate is going to be much higher? Or do you think that it's still going to remain like it was in the Switch 1?
I think it's going to go way higher. Something that, you know, we did not see in this Direct, that was probably my biggest take or disappointment, was, you know, we have kind of a long running theory on how NSO and Nintendo's push into live service games is going to, you know, not only utterly transform the financials, but kind of kickstart mass adoption of NSO and its pricing in a way that I gotta hold back on talking about. You know, the fact that it wasn't there, you know, was one of the biggest disappointments, but I think they'll save that for the, you know, at least the beginning of that for the Nintendo Direct. So let's just assume that doesn't exist. I thought that there were a number of factors and kind of small nuanced incentives that they have done with regarding membership or adoption to NSO that are going to drive a lot of new subscriptions. And, you know, I think, you know, we're going to see pricing lifted on the base tiers and a new higher price subscription tier layered into the service here pretty quickly. But the answer is yes. I think not only are number absolute subscriptions going much, much higher, I think the attach rate in terms of the installed base of active users is going to go higher as well. And, you know, there's a number of factors here, namely the TAM expansion towards higher end hardcore gamers who, you know, we have, for example, credit card data that shows what we have long believed kind of definitively, which is the average ARPU for a high end gamer is about, you know, 33% higher on average for these gamers relative to, you know, Nintendo. So as the TAM expansion takes place with, you know, the Switch 2, and, you know, a much larger cohort of higher end gamers adopt the Switch 2, you know, kind of naturally, almost all of these gamers, you know, are online subscribers that spend quite a bit more, you know, on balance than its existing user base. So I think that's going to be a big deal. I also think it is super, the way they dealt with what you referenced, which is how, you know, for the first time in history, and, you know, notably with the console switch over to the PS5, there was nothing like this in place at Sony or Microsoft. But, you know, the day, you know, I mean, if you're talking or thinking through the carrot, you know, that are out there as far as driving upgrade demand, the mere fact that, you know, on day one, your entire Switch 1, and this is if you're an existing Switch, you know, owner, your entire library of games, for the most part, is upgraded graphically and in terms of you know, the frame rate it runs at. Or I shouldn't say the entire library, but the vast majority of your favorite games, certainly so. But Nintendo didn't make it just free, which I was overjoyed to see. You know, it's actually like a three-tiered system. So you have free upgrades for games like Mario Odyssey, you know, and they, you know, a lot of the Zelda games, they recently provided a list of what would be automatically upgraded due to the, you know, NVIDIA's DLSS hardware being inside the console. But then you have a $10 incremental price point charging for the upgrades to, say, you know, two of their biggest, you know, games from the first generation, which was Zelda Breath of the Wild and Zelda Tears of the Kingdom. Here you have some new content, but not a ton. And I'm thinking of, like, you know, how the app that they built into their new app will follow you and tell you where the Korok seeds are on top of the upgraded graphics and, you know, much higher frame rate. So I think they're charging 10, and that is free, to your point, included with an NSO. So, you know, absent that, I think the $10 upgrade charge would have just a massive attach rate, but it's actually kind of better in this case because it's going to drive more people to the service. And, you know, obviously Nintendo Switch Online is, you know, online recurring revenue. And so, you know, I like that trade-off. And then you have the $20 charge for existing Switch 1 games that are coming out with considerably more content. So think new levels and things like that. And that's going to be $20. So when you think about the effect to the bottom line, when you have this massive, you know, 129 million strong install base and, you know, like $1.5 billion in total software sales, that, you know, you're going to, from the consumer perspective, they're going to, you know, a lot of those games are going to be automatically upgraded for free. I'd argue that's enough of a reason in and of itself to upgrade. And, you know, if you are, you know, an NSO member, then, you know, a good chunk of games will come out with new and improved better content on top of just better graphics and higher frame rates. And that'll be $10, but it'll be free to you because, you know, you already subscribe. And, you know, then you have the $20 price point for certain games, where, you know, they're putting meaningful, you know, time into developing these new levels or whatnot. So a giant chunk of, you know, it's hard to, you know, pin down exactly how much kind of free money, you know, materializes out of thin air as people upgrade to the Switch 2 and adopt online. But you don't need a scale to know a man's fat. And it's just a really, really, I mean, everything that we saw in the Direct, I thought were extremely smart in terms of pushing people towards having a subscription account, i.e. NSO, upgrading to the Switch 2 from the Switch 1, pushing the transition to digital. All of those kind of investment analysis variables. I'm not sure they could have done it better. I guess your question was simple. What do I think it's going to happen to NSO? I think it's going to be dramatically accretive in terms of membership, in terms of, you know, the basic price point, which, you know, one thing people don't really think about is since NSO was launched in 2018, the competing online services and their various tiers, but let's just focus on the low end, have more than doubled their pricing. Nintendo has not raised prices at all since, you know, Nintendo Switch Online's release. And I think with the Switch 2, and I think they were wise to kind of not, you know, reveal anything on pricing, you know, until a later date. But, you know, they just added Nintendo GameCube games. You know, I'm not going to get into like my theories on the higher price subscription tier, but I do think you're going to see a equivalent, you know, increase in the base and, you know, expansion pass tiers, for the sole reason that, you know, they haven't, you know, raised prices a dime. You know, meanwhile, their competitors have more than doubled pricing. And, you know, we're getting, you know, either the consumers getting more and more value, more classic systems, more, you know, retro games, and, you know, I think a whole lot more. So I think the value proposition is quite good relative to the low end pricing tiers of its competitors, and the pricing umbrella that Nintendo has to not just raise prices, but to grow total membership. And, you know, therefore the attach rate is quite large as well. So like I said, snowballing, exponentially growing profits over the next 3 to 4 years across, you know, the entire company is, I think, a lock. And there's just so many different ways we can get there, given the flexibility Nintendo has, because they haven't been gouging their customers' eyes out with price increases every year. They're in a very good position.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk quickly about valuation. I think the last time we spoke, Nintendo was, this was July 2024. So not a year, but almost a year. Mm-hmm. I think Nintendo was trading, the ADR was trading around 12 or 13. This was pre-gen carry trade flash crash. And now the stock is hovering somewhere around $17. Can you share some of your, let's say, napkin math around Nintendo's valuation, and where do you think the Switch 2 cycle could take the stock?
Yeah, so I'll say this because we're still buying more. I think that if you know, internally we have sandbagged every core KPI to a kind of ridiculous degree just to assume we're kind of wrong about everything and what that means for the stock price going forward. So I think when we, you know, do that, you know, from where we're at today, you know, are we at 17-ish? I'm not sure, but, you know, call it a $75 billion EV, $90 billion market cap, or actually, I think it's lower than that. I think that was, you know, closer towards 20, but right around here, I think there's a kind of worst case embedded IRR of 20% plus. And I think, you know, gun to my head, if I were still trying to be conservative where I think, you know, we'll see Nintendo's equity 3 years from today, I think 3X is, you know, a pretty much a lock. I can't imagine any scenario where it doesn't double. So, you know, I still think the stock is extraordinarily cheap, regardless of what the future holds. And that is with assuming, you know, a very glacial pace in terms of the digital mix shift, the historical attach rate, for example, NSO not going up, you know, the attach rate on software sales being below what it has been for the first 3 to 4 years, really for every major modern console since 2013. There's a lots of levers and, you know, ways you can kind of arrive at your price target based on certain assumptions being set, you know, at X or Y. But even when we kind of try and be trollish and make things considerably worse than we actually think they will turn out, we're still getting a 20% IRR, you know, over the next 5 years from here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's interesting. I think I would agree with that. So thank you very much, Ryan, for coming again to the podcast. I think it was a great conversation, a great update on Nintendo, which I think a lot of people are going to be surprised how different this episode was to the first one, but it's because we have a lot more information than we had then.
100%. It's been a blast. And, you know, hopefully that wasn't too ranty because of exactly that, because we have so much more kind of where we had no information before. Now we have certainty. So it's a lot of fun to kind of walk through that and all the implications. I think it is priced today on a risk adjusted basis at a level that is about as attractive as it's been at, you know, relative to any point since we got involved all the way back in 2018. So
especially if you take into account the uncertainty that in the world right now.
Oh yeah.
And how Nintendo would be able to thrive through that. And we talked about this in the episode.
Yes. I mean, that is maybe above all, that's the reason to get long Nintendo, is that even in the worst case in terms of the macro and economy, you know, I can sleep like a baby, even with our extraordinarily outsized portfolio weighting. And that is incredibly scarce and rare, you know, just in general, but certainly with respect to the world we may be entering in. And, you know, whether or not we get an actual regime change, I don't know. But I know that Nintendo should do well either way. And that's a great thing.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
Thank you, buddy. Appreciate it.